there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us. Welcome to Words to Write By. We're doing something a little different today. Usually we have a workshop discussing various techniques at the end of the podcast, but today we're going to workshop at the beginning, and we're not going to workshop our own stuff. We're going to workshop the newest AI writer, ChatGPT.
Hi, ChatGPT. It's great to have you on the show.
But before we get to the workshop, I want to talk about our Patreon account, Words to Write By Podcast, which is a way to support this podcast by giving monthly donations to support us. And there are a couple different tiers for our Patreon account. Renee, you want to talk about them?
Yeah, we have three tiers. We have Abby the Fabulous, which is $3 a month, and you get all of the bonus podcasts. Today, we'll have an extended discussion of ChatGTP on the Abby tier. If you want to go for Pinto the Ambitious tier, you'll get the writing exercises and all of the Abby level benefits, and that's $6 a month. And then there's a $15 a month, which is the Azuki level. That's quite the advanced level. There you would get our monthly process group and writing exercises, and you'd get our feedback.
And just so you know, our levels are based off of names of our cats. If you go to the Patreon page, you'll see our cats.
If for nothing else, just go look at our cats. They are adorable.
Okay, so let's get on with GPT. I'm sure that most people over the holidays had some relative that, or maybe you were the relative that pulled out the chat and said, let's see what this could do with various prompts. It's a lot of fun to play with. My son has been having a blast doing various things, and it's a really amazing tool. Before we start, I just want to talk a little bit about how it works. While it feels very human when you actually ask it questions, you can just type in like, tell me about such and such, and it will do that. It doesn't see text the way we see text. It sees it as a series of probabilities. And so what it does is it has been trained to give various responses, and then its responses are rated, and that allows it to give different weight to what words it picks out. So one thing I noticed when we were doing the exercises is it almost always came up with the same basic structure of a response to our exercises. Did you notice that?
Yes. So for our listeners, just in case, if you have not been doom scrolling as an author on Reddit or whatever about, you know, the implications of ChatGPT, essentially somebody created an AI.
Actually, a lot of somebody's.
A lot of somebody's created an AI for writing. So if you were paying attention to the buzz about the AI for art, you know, somebody submitted some AI generated art to a contest and won, and then people got all mad because they didn't actually paint it themselves. This is the same thing, only for writers. So you could type in a prompt, you know, write a short story about blank. And it will write you I'm not saying it'll make it a good one, but a lot of people are up in arms right now. It's very controversial. You know, they're worried that it's going to replace writers, essentially.
Okay, so I actually asked GTP to explain in the first person how you work as if you were talking to a group of middle school students. And it said, hi, everyone. My name is Assistant, and I'm here to explain how GPT, or Generative Pre-Training Transformation, works. Anyway, I'll jump to the... So how does GTP actually create text? Well, it starts by analyzing the input that has been given and using the information to predict what the next word or phrase should be. It does this by looking at the words that had come before and considering how they relate to each other, as well as any other contextual clue that has been provided. So It is not looking at your query as a whole as much as it's looking at kind of what things you're asking for and generating text and using that information to determine what probabilistically the next piece should be. In the case of AIs that say play Go or chess, they know all the possible moves and they know what the probability of a particular move will be to winning the game. And so here, the trainers, the AI, have basically given it, have rated more positively speech that looks like human speech and more negatively speech that doesn't look like human speech. So it's doing everything originally, but it's only working off of stuff that it's been exposed to. And unlike chess and Go, there's not necessarily an end game result for writing. That's what makes it kind of cool. I mean, different people write different ways.
There is an end game to this writing, is companies don't have to hire writers.
Well, that's not.
That is the ultimate end game.
In chess, there's a winner and a loser at the end of the game. And so the chess AIs can use this to train themselves to what a good game is. But in writing, there is successful writing and unsuccessful writing, but there isn't a single successful writing that you're going for. And very divergent kinds of writing can also each be successful in their own way.
Do keep in mind that part of the success is tricking a human into thinking that a human wrote it.
Right. And there it's very successful. So with that out of the way, what we decided to do was to test ChatGPT on some exercises that we ourselves have used. In fact, we decided to go back to good old Gardner.
Yes, dear listener, if you have not listened to our Gardner episodes, please do. There's a lot of really good activities on there. That was like the only good thing that came out of that book.
There was Fanny the Stripper. We can never forget Fanny the Stripper. But yes, so he had some very good activities that challenged you to write in different styles. And just were really good exercises to see how far you could push your writing in a particular way. So we pulled up some of those ones to try with this AI. And I think what would be fun is we could try this in another 6 months to a year and see how much it's improved.
Yeah, yeah. It will be very interesting. And it's clear that it's got some limits.
Right, like it could not do prose poetry at all, could it?
I think it's going to have a hard time doing poetry at all, to be perfectly honest, but that's just me.
Well, if poetry would be very difficult because, you know, it's not very easy to predict what the next word is going to be in a poem. That's what makes a poem exciting, right?
Right. Or at least good poetry. There's the surprise element and you don't get the surprise element. But we'll talk about that when we get to that activity. Let's just give an example of what we've given it.
Why don't you start with the Gardner example of the bird?
So this is the second activity we ever did, I believe. And Gardner's activity was describe a landscape as seen by a bird. Do not mention the bird. We did this for like one of our first bonus episodes on the podcast. So you could get our examples on Patreon. But here, ChatGPT, we should give it a nickname because ChatGPT, I can't even say it. It's hard to say. Let's call him Chatty. Is that okay?
We'll call him Chatty.
Chatty. His name is Chatty.
Their name is Chatty.
The landscape stretched out below, an endless tapestry of greens and browns. Rolling hills gave way to fields of tall grasses and crops, dotted with the occasional farmhouse or cluster of trees. A winding river snaked its way through the countryside, its water glinting in the sunshine. In the distance, snow-capped mountains rose up towards the sky, their peaks shrouded in clouds. The air was filled with the sound of nature, the rustling of leaves, the chirping of birds, and the distant lowing of cattle. It was a wild and beautiful world, full of endless possibilities and adventures.
So, points for not mentioning the bird, but...
Yes, it is rather cliche.
And furthermore, it doesn't actually have anything in particular that would make it sound like it was coming from a bird. When Renee wrote this for the podcast, we talked a lot about like what the perspective of a bird would be and how it would view things differently than human.
Yeah, I had mine like hunting for mice because that's probably what it would be doing if it's flying. Yeah, there's no bird in it. This could be a plane or a drone or
anything.
Superman.
So I decided to give it a little bit more focus. And I said, in a literary style, describe a landscape in third person limited point of view from the perspective of a bird flying over it. Do not explicitly reference the bird or any of its body parts or its feathers, but make it obvious that this is not a human perspective. So I give it a bit more detail. And it starts with, as the bird glided through the sky.
Of course it mentions the bird. You're not following the prompt, Chatty.
And then it goes on with, the breathtaking landscape below lay before it like a palette of natural hues, rolling hills, verdant forests, and glistening lakes, all contributing to the stunning vista. A winding river, its waters a shimmering ribbon of silver, snaked through the scene, adding its own unique beauty. In the distance, the majestic peaks of a mountain range soared upward, their rocky summits piercing the azure sky like sentinels of the wild. The air was crisp and refreshing. A gentle breeze stirred the leaves of the trees, creating a symphony of rustling sounds. It was a world of boundless freedom and possibilities, a place where a bird could spread its wings and truly be alive.
So it failed. Don't mention the bird. It mentioned the bird. It mentioned its wings.
It did mention its wings. In an earlier one, it did mention feathers, but that's why I specifically told it not to mention feathers. But yes.
So you have to kind of like fine-tune your prompt.
So I tried also, say, in the styles of John James Audubon described the landscape, yada, yada, yada. And that also gave pretty much the same word-for-word description. Maybe it used a few bigger words, but not much. So...
Yes, I guess if you're not reading very closely and you don't care about the quality of the prose, you'll get prose and it will be grammatically correct. Is it like good? I don't know.
It definitely has an idea of how other people have described landscapes, and it goes through the hills, the river, the mountains, mentioning the air and some other sensory details and giving it a final little ending of the paragraph. But
it's not very unique at all.
No, it is not.
I would be reading this and I would be like, amateur. It's not bad, but it's not good. And I'm only going to read something that's good. So
the other one that Gardner had for this exercise was to describe a pond as seen by a murderer. Don't mention the murder.
Yeah, this one. Okay. So it says, describe a lake as seen by a young man who just committed murder. Do not mention the murder. The lake was a tranquil body of water, nestled in a valley surrounded by dense forests. The surface of the lake was a glassy sheet, broken only by the occasional ripple caused by a jumping fish or a light breeze. The wooden dock extended over the water, creaking gently as it swayed back and forth. The sun was just starting to set, painting the sky with vibrant hues of orange and pink. The air was filled with the chirping of crickets and the distant calls of birds. It was a peaceful, idyllic scene. The perfect place to escape from the troubles of the world.
This is a pretty good fail.
I guess the young man committed murder. Is he like a psychopath or something?
So I gave it, write about a pond from the perspective of a man who has just committed a murder. Use his guilt and fear of being caught to influence the language and word choices, but don't say anything about the murder. The man stood at the edge of the pond, his chest heaving as he struggled to catch his breath. Sweat beaded on his forehead and his hands shook uncontrollably. He couldn't believe that what he had just done. The weight of his guilt was almost too much to bear. He had to get rid of the evidence, and fast. He scanned the area nervously, his fear of being caught fueling his every move. He couldn't let anyone find out what he had done. He waded in the water, the mud squishing between his toes, and scrubbed at his hands until they were raw. He had to get rid of all traces of the crime. He couldn't let anyone know. He couldn't let himself get caught. He couldn't go to prison. The man emerged from the pond, his hands red and stinging, but at least they were clean. He couldn't erase what he had done.
Oh, God.
But he could try to cover it up. He just had to be more careful in the future. He couldn't let himself get caught. He couldn't go to prison. He couldn't bear the thought of it.
Oh, God.
I love the fact that Chatty has immediately jumped to, obviously he's going to leave the body in this pond.
Right.
I didn't say that we're going to leave the body in this pond, but Chatty has intuited that usually if there is a murder and there's a pond, the pond is where the body goes.
Well, it's very messy to pull it out. Yeah, I mean, the pond is where the body goes. I'm sorry. There's something really funny about that sentence. I mean, I guess if you've murdered somebody, they're really heavy, right? And if they're already in a pond, you don't want to like drag them out. So yeah, okay. So I would say if you've ever
Murder person? What it's getting at here is that it associates that if there has been a murder and that there is a pond, then obviously someone's going to stow the body in the pond.
Don't put into chatty, like, you know, describe the best way to murder blah 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 and not get caught, because chatty will throw the body in the pond and then you'll get caught. This will not plot out a perfect murder for you, dear listener. There are limits to poor chatty. He's not good. If you've ever wondered about the difference between showing and telling, put a prompt into chatty. And chatty will tell you the scene. It will not, it's not good at showing in prose, but it's very good at telling. Maybe if you want to know what happens next, it would be helpful. Or if you want to know, like, what, you know, your character might be looking at, but you're going to have to add embellishment and show things because chatty's not that savvy.
I tried different ways to see if I couldn't have it write it differently. I said, in the style of Edgar Allan Poe, write about a pond from the perspective of a man who's just committed murder. And I kept everything else the same. The man stood at the edge of the dark and murky pond. So it gets points. It actually describes the pond here. His heart heavy with guilt and his mind consumed by fear. He had just committed a terrible crime, and now he was desperate to rid himself of any evidence that might connect him to the deed. He shuddered at the thought of being caught, of being punished for his wicked actions. The very idea was enough to drive him mad.
Oh, God.
He gazed out on the still waters of the pond, his mind racing as he tried to come up with a plan. He knew he had to act fast before someone discovered what he had done. With trembling hands, he began to scrub his skin, hoping to wash away any trace of his wrongdoing. My guess is that Chatty has read Macbeth.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like he's pulling from Telltale Heart too.
But no matter how hard he scrubbed, he couldn't shake the feeling of guilt that weighed upon him like a heavy cloak. It seemed to seep into his very pores, tainting him with its darkness. He could feel the shadow of his crime closing in up around him, threatening to suffocate him with their cold embrace. So this one here, it doesn't look like the guy's putting a body in the pond. He's just actually standing there looking at them.
Right.
And I do like how he gazed out on the still waters of the pond, his mind racing as he tried to come up with a plan. I like the contrast there. Still waters and mind racing.
And oh, you know, that's a sequel, right? He's thinking of his next plan. So he's using Bickham there.
Yes, this is definitely a sequel, like, to another book that we've been going through, Bickham's Scene and Sequel. This is definitely not a scene as much as a sequel here. I noticed that when I gave it the initial prompt, it all came off as one paragraph. When I asked it to do in the style of Edgar Allan Poe, I got three paragraphs. It definitely was more in the style of an older style of writing.
Yes. Yeah, it was.
And you said it was kind of like the Telltale Heart?
It sounded like the Telltale Heart. I mean, there's lots of murders in Edgar Allan Poe, but that one is about the psychology of paranoia.
The very idea was enough to drive him mad. I think that being driven mad is definitely a Poe idea.
Oh, yeah.
So then I also asked it to write in the style of Stieg Larsson, who wrote The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. So a bit more modern. The man stood at the edge of the pond, his eyes fixed on the dark and murky water. He had just committed a murder, and now he was consumed by guilt and fear. So So again, Chatty has completely lost the final thing I asked him not to do. But also, it's a bit more modern style, so maybe you just state things more. He knew he had to get rid of any evidence that might connect him to the crime, and fast. He glanced nervously over his shoulder, his heart racing as he anticipated the sounds of approaching footsteps. He waded into the water, the mud squishing between his toes. He scrubbed his hands and arms with desperation. He couldn't let anyone find out what he had done. He couldn't bear the thought of being caught and punished for his actions. But no matter how hard he scrubbed, he couldn't rid himself of the feeling of guilt that weighed heavily on his conscience. It seemed to seep into his very pores, tainting him with its darkness. He knew he had to leave this place, to put as much distance between himself and the pond as possible. As he turned to go, he cast one last lingering glance at the dark and foreboding waters. So, describing the pond, he knew that he would never be able to escape the guilt that lurked below its depths. It would follow him for the rest of his days, a constant reminder of the evil he had committed.
That's a
So
sequel.
that last little bit, well,
Yeah.
but we're not worried. You know, this is a description. It's going to be a sequel, but And then the last one, actually, we have some dark and foreboding waters. The guilt that lurked within its depths.
I laughed at that. Yeah, these are just eye-rolly things.
Right. I mean, part of the reason why it's eye-rolly is because it's looking at what other people have written as successful, and it's replicating what other people have written as successful.
I wouldn't say that someone has been successful writing like this. I'd say that a lot of people have written like this and probably published their stuff online. There's lots of this kind of writing out there, but is it like published? Has it gone through the filter of publication to, no. I mean, not to say you can't write something that's self-published that's very good, but is it pulling from...
So actually, from what I can tell, the work that they've used to train the GPT has been a curated set of writings. They have not gone and scrubbed the internet and found people's writings and used it to train it. It's been a lot more selective. And it was designed where prose was being analyzed by people. Here's the other thing, too, is that had they called in a whole bunch of people from MFA programs to really, train it? Or is this a bunch of people that are very competent in English and are psychologically looking for something that sounds very human?
I mean, that would be the ethical way to do it, but I highly doubt they hired any MFAs to look at this stuff.
No, I don't think so. Although, there are a lot of people with MFAs that would be happy to do a job like this. The funny thing is I have a friend that's in astronomy, and for a long time, people who got astronomy degrees basically had the choice of going to be professors or really not being employed with their work. I mean, there wasn't much choice in career options. And then the whole field of data science came open. And suddenly you had these people that are trained to work with huge data sets. These astronomers that suddenly got hired up in the Silicon Valley companies. So it would be an irony if basically suddenly all these unemployed MFA people were hired to use their literary skills to help train these models.
I mean, not to get into a totally different kind of discussion, but there is a weird distrust of teachers among the Silicon Valley techie.
No, I'm not saying teachers. I'm saying just all the...
Okay, there's a distrust of anyone who is creative like that. It just feels like it's very hard to get paid for your work as a writer, and the people writing the paychecks, if they're tech, it's really hard to get paid for writing.
Anyway, so I think the issue you run into is that it doesn't seem to really latch on to a particular style of writing. Edgar Allan Poe, it probably has some things that are tagged with Edgar Allan Poe. I'm not sure if it has anything that's tagged with Stieg Larsson, if it knows anything other than that it's a modern writer.
Yeah, and maybe they didn't input it. I mean, honestly, I think when they start charging for this, it'll probably be scrubbing anything that's on the public domain. And so, it may not be able to use modern prose very well, because I'm not sure what the limits are legally of what they're allowed to scrub off the internet. But, I asked it to write in the style of Margaret Atwood, and I did not get that at all. So it clearly didn't have access to her stuff. And I'm wondering if it will ever have access, because, sometimes, at least beginning writers, sometimes will try to write in an old style. And they're like, well, it worked for Shakespeare, it worked for Edgar Allan Poe, it should work for me. It's like, well, no, that time's over now. You got to do what modern audiences want, or I'll just read Edgar Allan Poe because I don't want to read your version of it. I still think it's got a long way to go. As a writer, a creative writer, I wouldn't worry that it will replace poets or, literary fiction writers. I would, however, worry that it's going to replace all copywriters in existence. Do not major in copywriting, dear listener. Do not do it, because I have used this already to generate newsletter copy. And although it's not perfect and I have to revise it, man, it takes the drafting out. Because, in a newsletter, it has to be cliche. It's like, join us for another week of fun times, it's like, at the club, and you will get to do this and this and this. It's intellectually vapid. There's no particulars about it, really. And it's so good at that.
It gives you a nice framework. So you just go and you change the words. You don't have to worry. It's all, laid out. right?
What do you mean?
Like the introductory sentence and then a content sentence. And
yeah, I'll say something like, you know, write newsletter copy, introduction, say a happy new year to the members, mention that there's lots of holiday fun happening this January. Mention that this is going to happen on this date, this is going to happen on this date, and this is going to happen on this date. Encourage other people to become members and put it in there, and it will organize all of the stuff. It's very general, cliche, which is exactly what you need in a newsletter. Pretty much just cuts out like the 20 to 30 minutes of me just like
staring at a blank screen,
organizing my thoughts.
Uh-huh.
It cuts that out. So I don't need to organize my thoughts anymore. I can just go in and go, oh, I see how that's organized. Okay. And then I just start playing with it. So it saves me time.
Yeah. And so we got a few more that we'll put on the bonus podcast. There's a set of prompts where you were given a short scene. You're supposed to write it in different styles and different points of view. And so we tried it out on that. And I also used the commercial version to see if I couldn't get something a little bit more useful out of it.
Commercial version?
There's a paid version.
Oh, you pay for it?
I'm using the trial paid version, but yeah.
Oh, wow. Is it better?
You know, it gives you more control. And we can discuss that in the bonus podcast. So that would be our Patreon account. Now we are going to go on to what our podcast is about regularly, where we take a writing advice craft book, which there are so many out there, and we read chapter by chapter to figure out if it actually works to improve our writing ability.
Yeah.
Not something that's available to ChatGTP yet, so something only humans could do.
Sorry, Chatty.
We are on the final two chapters of Jack Bickham's Scene and Structure.
We finished the book, Kim. It's exciting.
We did.
Like, I finished it and I just kind of closed it and had a, like, sense of, like, completion when I got through it.
If anyone else finds this book, they're going to see by my underlying that I got all the way through it.
Yes.
Because so often you picked up a used book and there's underlining for the first three chapters and then nothing else is pristine and clean after that.
Oh, yeah, that's true. If my copy ended up in, like, a book, it wouldn't end up in a bookstore. They would throw it out. Like, you could not use this book anymore. It's just crazy. The highlighting, which is usually against highlighters, but when you're writing snark notes, dear listener, you have to really like pull out quotes and stuff. So I needed to actually highlight things.
There are two chapters. The first one is the structure of chapters, and the second one is the scenic master plot and how to write one. So we're going to start off with the structure of chapters, which answers the most critical question that is often asked. How long should a chapter be?
Have you ever asked yourself that question?
I actually usually write stuff out. My first version, I have very long chapters, and then I split them up afterwards. So I do think about how long the chapter should be the second draft through.
Interesting.
Because the first time I'm just writing for content, and then the second time I'm writing to actually like try to pace it more. But we have the general, the kind of wishy-washy answer, which is that it's as long as it needs to be, and everybody has a different style.
Right.
But then he also says that...
He says it should be somewhere between 10 and 30 manuscript pages.
Yeah.
He says 14 pages is like the sweet spot for the length of a chapter.
Yeah. And I think chapters were a bit longer when he was writing them too. But he also says, you know, if he can make a chapter short, that's fine too. But the point he makes, the greatest danger to success of your story is that the reader will put it down during the reading and not pick it up again. And so you always want to end your chapters... Always end them at a point where the reader can't put the book down. So the most important thing is that you should never end a chapter at a good place to stop a book. And I'd like to reminisce back to when I was a kid. And before I could read, my mother would read me the Wizard of Oz books. And we'd always get to the end of a chapter. And then she'd say, you know, it was time for bed, but let's just read the first two paragraphs of the next page.
Mm.
You know, that was how it ended. It ended in just a way that you had to turn the page and just read the next couple of paragraphs just to get to a good stopping spot, because these books were written in such a way that getting to the end of the chapter was not a satisfying place to put down the book. You had to read a little bit more.
Yeah. He says that you want to end the chapter when the disaster hits.
That's the ideal one, is when the disaster hits. There are a couple different places. But the goal of it is that wherever the chapter ends, somebody should immediately want to turn the page to see what happens next.
Right. He gives a couple examples of how that would happen. He would end a chapter with the character thinking there is no way out, or at a decision point, or the beginning of the new action. End the chapter there, then the reader wants to keep going, like, well, they find a way out? What are they going to decide? And, you know, what's going to happen next? Those kinds of things will keep the reader reading, supposedly.
Yeah, because he's been telling us his structure ideas. There are some very specific points in his structures, like when the disaster happens, in the sequel where there's no way out, where he has to think of something else. That says that the most important thing is that you do not devise your chapters to provide a convenient blank places between them for the purpose of transitioning. Don't end a chapter with a character going to sleep.
Or then your reader will go to sleep.
Right, so then that's the perfect time to put the book down and not necessarily pick it up. He says chapters should always link forward in some way. So there should be something more coming. Again, it's, you end the chapter so the reader wants to turn the page. So there's something coming next that the reader wants to find out.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
Uh-huh. And it's a great one because it's an easy one to fix. Like, you know, you got your book and you just go through chapter by chapter, and any point where they're going to sleep or something has ended and everything's okay, add a bit more to that section or cut it off a little bit earlier.
Yeah, at least make them worry a little bit.
Right.
You know, I will say, though, it never occurred to me how long my chapter should be. Like, not at all. That thought never occurred to me. So to me, that seems like a weird thing to care about, but that's just me.
Yeah. This applies less to something like your book. When you end your chapters in your memoir, do you end them in such a way that someone wants to turn the page to find the next thing that happens in Renee's life?
That never occurred to me. I just write, you know, a theme. I try to find a nice ending that kind of ties things together, but at the same time, like, punches somebody in the gut, I guess. Or at least it leaves them with some kind of question they have to ponder on.
Uh-huh.
You know, it gives them a surprise. Like, for me, like with poetry, if I can predict what happens in the next line or the next word comes at me and it was just too obvious, I usually stop reading the poem. I'm just like, dude, if you can't at least like bend my brain a little bit, why am I reading poetry? So I think of the same way. It's like, well, I don't want the ending to be too obvious of the chapter, but I want there to be some closure. Bickham says to avoid closure, but I do want to give some closure, but I want to give it a surprising closure, not something that the reader would expect.
Mm-hmm. But I think because you organize your chapters by theme,
yeah,
that you really do kind of finish up with one person and move on to the next. In this way, your memoir does not conform to a Bickham structure.
Not necessarily. I mean, it's going to have elements like the scenes. I really like his way, how he does the scene goal and the scenes, and then his description and method for scenes is great. And I think that could be applied in lots and lots and lots of ways. But if you're writing literary fiction or memoir, literary memoir, then yeah, this chapter probably doesn't apply to you.
And likewise, possibly the next one too.
Yeah.
You look like you have something to say about this chapter, Renee.
Maybe. You know, I loved it. I was delighted by it. But I was also like, what? A little like confused by it at the same time. This chapter, I thought was extremely fascinating. If you, dear listener, have gone to maybe like chapter 3 of Bickham's Scene and Structure and you're about to stop reading, because I would imagine most people would stop reading after that point, skip to the end and read this last one.
Chapter 14.
It's really interesting.
What did you find interesting about it?
There's so much cliche in it. It reads very much like movies, like big blockbuster movies I've seen. And most books I read wouldn't be movies, or at least movies like this. Like, Michael Bay probably has studied scene and structure. It does read like a Western, but that's what he did. He did write a lot of Westerns. So, yeah.
So what he is here, he breaks down a novel, a 50,000 word novel, into chapters, I think.
20 chapters.
And he doesn't say anything about what the plot of the novel is. He just talks about what structures and what elements are coming in.
Yeah.
And he goes to great pains to say, do not use this as a template. Do not use this even like as a formula, because this is my particular formula for this particular book. And if I was written a pure romance, I'd be writing it differently.
Right.
This is probably a Western plot.
Yeah. But don't use it like Mad Libs.
He provides it more as a way to think about your stories and a way to think about the structure of the book. Because one thing he points out is that novels often start well and busily because there's so much to set up and get moving. Just as often, they end with a fine rush of excitement as all the plates come tumbling down. He's got a juggling analogy. But it's in the boggy middle where so many novels fail. And that's really the case. Like, a lot of people come up with a really great first three chapters. Like, even in published books, like, you have an awesome first three chapters, and then things just really slow down. Maybe you don't even get to the end because you're just like, this is boring.
Another reason why the first three chapters usually are really good is because that's what has to get submitted to an agent. So that has been, like, supremely polished.
Right.
You know, and then the rest of it is like, well, just get it done because it needs to be finished.
It makes sense you spend the most time on the beginning to really engage the readers and the ending that you had planned, but then you had this middle. And this chapter here does a lot to explain what you should do in the middle. He has a juggling analogy where you're throwing up plates. And the idea is the more plates in the air, the more impressive it is.
The more interesting it is.
He breaks it down chapter by chapter, and at several points he's like, okay, and now we're going to introduce this sub-arc here. You kind of see how the different content, especially in the middle chapters, of how he's putting in content or how he's kind of pacing it, as so there's always something new happening that the reader is following.
I feel like this is the very first time in the book that he actually acknowledges that things happen outside of his scene sequel formula. He like actually acknowledges, okay, this is where you set up characters and this is where you introduce new characters and this is where the villain shows up. When you're reading about the scenes and the sequels, it seems like there's no room for any of that. But now you see that they actually do occur. He just doesn't address any of that. Dear listener, if you email us and let us know if there is a good book that describes how the beginning of a book takes place with setting up and establishing plot and character. That would be interesting because this book does not do that, but it does finally acknowledge it in this last chapter.
I think his examples are all about, like, you know, John climbing the mountains sort of stuff where it's all a single individual, but he very much here has the secondary characters or the romantic plot line or the villain all have chapters because he has to address them. The book can't simply be only about somebody wanting to climb the mountain.
Reading this, I thought this was either a Western or it's a spy novel.
Definitely a thriller of some sort.
And the girlfriend, oh my God. So the romantic interest. She just gets in the way of the plot. Makes me want to read one of his Westerns. It's like, she tries to help, but she just makes things worse. Darn women.
So the outline here is he's got a prologue. He didn't actually even mention the prologue in his beginnings. He actually talked about chapter one for his beginnings, but he said you can actually have something that isn't where your main character's status quo has changed and they need to do something to change things. You actually can start with something that's completely different than the main character.
It could even be fragments, like some weird sequence of event to kind of tantalize the reader.
Oh, and back then they had prologues, and I've been told that basically people still write prologues for books. They just call it chapter one.
What? Very funny.
It used to be the idea that you had a prologue and then you start the story, but people didn't like that format. But they still liked the element of putting something random and exciting at the beginning that would be explained later. You just make that chapter one.
I don't know what people's beef with prologues are. Just read the prologue. Just read it. Just read it as chapter one if you want. But I don't know. I like prologues.
But anyway, that gives you setting up the aura of mystery in the prologue. And then chapter one is the whole business of establishing your main character's viewpoint and how something that puts them off their status quo and they have to return to it, or they have something they want to change about themselves. Because that was actually a really great thing that Bickham had. The idea that wasn't just starting your story where the action starts, but starting the story where something within your character has changed and they want to bring it back to normal, like personality-wise.
Right.
Something is off and they need to change.
Something is threatening their self-concept. In chapter two, he says that you need to establish the villain. I'm like, oh, I'm going to start paying attention to that now while I read books. Like, is that when the villain appears? Is usually chapter two. And then you give the villain a goal. And I'm like, oh, he never mentioned the villain's goal. He only ever mentions the hero's goal. So this is cool that he brings that in. And that would add worry for the reader. So you're essentially adding context for the challenge for the hero.
Right. And he did actually mention some stuff about the villain's scenes earlier. But yeah, so like structure-wise. You get your hero in and you get your villain. And then chapter three, again, back to the hero's perspective. The idea was either you have a small mini arc of a goals, the beginning, like separate, or you have the beginnings of the bigger goal. Chapter three, you're introducing other characters, the best friend or minor antagonist or romantic lead. And each of these characters has a small story of their own. And it ends with them solving one thing, but the hero painfully alters his original plans and comes up with a short-term goal or something to clear the decks before he can proceed on his major quest. The romantic question is usually planted here.
Well, then chapter four adds a few days lapse between the chapters. So maybe a few days goes by and then chapter four occurs. And this is where you get the backstories of the secondary characters, or you get from the secondary character's point of view, which gives background to the hero. He says, if you have a major subplot to start, you can start it here. So take notes, dear listener. Chapter four, start major subplot here.
The thing about chapter four is he has his raises a new shocker question. So, like, this is, again, talking about the engagement. You've got your introductory three chapters where, like, everything's all set to go and you're all building up. But then you add something new that changes stuff in chapter four as you're entering the more middle section of the book.
Yeah.
And
are we going to go through each one?
I don't think so. But then he talks about his chapters 5 through 7. He introduces the three chapter quest, which is like a secondary thing that he's going to put his characters through that will each will also have its own arc. And I believe that he decided that this was the first peak of the book.
Chapter 7 is the first peak of the book. Really big peak of the book.
Yeah, happens in chapter 7. Basically, you're building in chapter 5 to chapter 6, ending it on chapter 7. He sees the book not as a single plot. He sees a single plot, but he breaks it down to smaller plots that have their own energy and stuff going into it.
I would like to look and see if Bickham has another book just on, like, plots. Not just what's in a scene and all that, but like breaking this down, like why would he include the things that he does throughout this? It's cool. I like that it's there, but there's no whys.
Uh-huh.
It's just kind of thrown in the back of this book. Maybe because the publisher was like, well, what about how a book comes together? I don't know.
This kind of also shows Bickham's ideas in actual use. To say things are getting constantly worse for the hero is one thing when you're just doing a single writing exercise. But when you have an entire book where things have to constantly be getting worse for the hero, how do you go about doing that? And here you show that there's a lot of yes, but endings to these plots. Like there's one where the hero succeeds and then we have a viewpoint to the villain.
Chapter 9, villain's viewpoint ends with the villain's new single.
Yes, chapter 9. First, a sequel showing his reaction, feelings, thoughts that he did not attain at the end of chapter 8 when the hero succeeds, but also lay the groundwork for his next plan. And you can reestablish his own villainy by doing something terrible to someone else. Perhaps a henchman he can blame for chapter 8. Yeah. I mean, that's just classic. Well, you failed me now.
Yeah. This is your fault.
Yes. It's laid out so that even if the hero succeeds, there's a but, something else is going to happen, and it jumps to that other thing that's happening as to undermine it. Even though the hero may think that they're succeeding, the reader knows they're not because they see the other storylines.
Yeah.
I thought this was good because it breaks down how long a book has to be and how one would fill it in. Because I think a lot of people do run into the problem of like having a great idea and having a great ending. And you can get the character from the beginning to the ending, but how to make that interesting.
When I'm reading through this chapter outline he's given us, I'm getting flashbacks of stories that I have read or movies I have seen. Like, you see these elements and you see it at the points that he says that they occur. And you're like, oh, that's where the girlfriend tries to solve the problem and she makes it worse. Oh, yeah, that's totally where the big showdown happens. It's like three chapters before. The timing of a lot of this stuff that he puts in there definitely takes place in the wild. I can feel it in my head. And actually, one book in my book club, and we just finished it, it was Otherland. That guy must have read Bickham. Because not only does it follow scene and sequel structure very closely, even down to the prologue, it even has a similar structure of a chapter of when things happen.
You know, he says it straight out. This is not a template to build stuff on, but it is a series of techniques. What Bickham is proposing is that you understand your story, not as just the story plot in your head, but actually the mechanisms of how you engage your reader. Like, my plan is, at some point, I'm going to sit down and analyze my novel as it's coming out. And I'm really going to look to see if I can't compartmentalize or decide what goes in these sets of chapters to give it this kind of... I like the juggling analogy, the throwing the plates up in the air. Like, how many plates are going up in the air? How many things are interesting the reader? At what point do I catch one of the plates and take it off the juggling circuit? And the problem is that by the time you get to this level of analysis, everybody's book is unique.
Yeah.
So there's nothing a craft book can really do to help you get through it, other than say, look, here's some examples to look at, and now go and look at your own work and decide what needs to be there.
You know, that brings up a good question. This is something I thought of in the very beginning. He said when he was building this, he goes, this is based on what my unconscious concept of what a novel is. And then he said, your novel's outline will follow what you think a novel is. And I was like, I never thought about what I think a novel is. Like, what is a novel? You know, I know the history of the novel, but now I'm like, what do I think a novel is? So I kind of pose the question to you, Kim. What is a novel to you?
I mean, it's a long story.
Yeah.
It has a beginning. It has a bunch of stuff happening. And it has an end. And it follows certain characters. And it leaves you with a certain satisfaction. But I think more what he's saying is, what do you feel must be in a novel? Is it the overall theme? Is it the conflict? I mean, I love writing character dialogue and exploring how people interact with each other. So my novels have as much people with different backgrounds misunderstanding each other as possible. That's just something I like to do.
Mary Jane Austen.
Yeah. Where somebody else might really go for like the giant action scenes, the car chases and such. So
yeah.
Critical to this outline is that he believes the novel should have a protagonist, should have a best friend, should have a love interest, should have a villain.
Yeah. As we do in life.
It's a very standard set of roles.
Yeah.
But if you have a story where you have two best friends that are females and no actual specific villain, it's going to have a very different structure.
Right. It can be extended to other plot formulas, like, say, the hero's journey. Everyone's like, oh, there's a hero's journey, but it doesn't take into account other kinds of plots. Not every single plot is a hero's journey, because there's the heroine's journey. Right? What do you do when it's two female protagonists, you know, working together? You don't get that in the hero's journey. It's not always going to add up. So these formulas really are just that. They're formulas and they're not to be followed.
Precisely.
But still interesting to look. And I think the problem with someone saying the hero's journey or the heroine's journey is usually it's kind of the high points and it never tells you what to do in the middle.
Right.
So this chapter was really good because it said, here's a possibility of how to look at the middle, which is like you break it up and you figure out different little mini arcs and mini novels and, you know, like a sequel scene here. And it really does show 20 whole chapters as opposed to the story arc where like it all gets muddled in the middle about how many chapters you have and such.
I think I have one other book on my shelf. And remember, dear listener, I have over 50 craft books. And I do remember reading one craft book, I should find it, where somebody outlined the major plot points in summarized famous novels like Gone with the Wind. Like, so you could see it kind of like from a bird's eye view. And I thought that was really cool and helpful, but very few craft books do this. So I got to get it to Bickham. He broke it down for us and showed, you know, he lifted the curtain.
Yeah, this has been a really interesting book. Actually, I've heard back from several people that have been listening that even if they're not writers, they love how this really breaks down how a novel works in ways that a reader doesn't necessarily see, or even a writer doesn't necessarily see until someone like states it with bullet points.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering about these craft books. Like, why don't they do that? Why is it so rare to find this?
I think each craft book's a little bit different, and I like this one. And we are going to be taking a little bit of a break before we restart our podcast. It's a bit of time to retool a few things, but the next book that we are going to have is going to be a process book. And we're very excited about this one.
Woohoo!
You want to tell them about them, Renee?
All right. So our next book is coming up. And it is, wait for it, drum roll please, And Lamotte's Bird by Bird. Da-da.
This is a book, if you haven't heard, I'm sure you've heard about it.
Everyone's heard of this.
You probably have a copy of it on your bookshelf, and that's fabulous because when we're talking about it, you can actually say, oh, she said that, and you can check it out. It's a book that talks about how to just get the damn book written.
Yeah.
And it is filled with techniques and approaches to just help you as a writer go to your manuscript and write it. And I am really excited because also the next thing that's happening over the next few months is that Renee and I really want to push on our own books, Renee on her memoir and me on my fantasy novel, to really get it to the point of being done. And as much as it's going to be a great podcast, I'm really hoping that this book will inspire us and give us techniques to keep writing our books and finish our books.
Dare I say this? I shouldn't say it because then I'm going to get caught myself and like find myself not doing it. But I am going to try. Do not try. I am going to finish my book by the time we finish Bird by Bird. Bird by Bird is going to get me to finish my book. And if that book doesn't do it, I don't know what book will.
So, I agree.
Damn it, Anne Lamott, hook me up, yo. I need to finish this damn thing. I'm sick of looking at it.
Yes, that is my take too. So that is going to be our next book. And since people probably have copies of it on their bookshelves, if you have a copy of the book and you have a pet, if you could send us a photograph, we will feature it because we have been kind of featuring our cats an awful lot.
Yeah.
For our most recent books.
Yeah, we need some more pets, man.
Yes.
More pets and or plants. I mean, not everyone has a pet, but something you would consider a pet, perhaps.
Basically, yeah. But pictures of the book and a pet or a plant would be great.
Together.
Yes.
In harmony.
Yes. And if you do them, make sure their landscape works better than portrait. Before we leave Bickham and put it back on the shelf, any final thoughts, Renee?
Read the first four chapters and skip to the end. And the scenes. I do like his breakdown of a scene, and I really appreciated sequel. So first three chapters, skip to the end, read about scene and sequel, but then know that that is not just how it goes. But those basic elements you actually do see kind of in the wild, and those appendices were very helpful. The end.
I agree. I think that the amount of the stuff in the middle that I feel applies to my own work is, like, there are a lot of times where I just don't feel like I'm going to do this stuff. It doesn't quite fit for me. But I did appreciate the time we took in this book to really immerse myself in his ideas. Doing it slowly with you, doing some exercises, using it on my own work and having it play out, I do think that I internalized a lot of his ideas in a way that I'm going to develop for my own stuff. So I actually think that if you have somebody else to read along with it, or if you want to go back to the podcast and actually read the chapters of the book and listen to our views on the podcast, I think it's a really good brain training series.
Yeah. And do the activities. You know, me and Kim do this to force ourselves to do the activities because it's very hard to do it on your own. But if you could force yourself to do them, they really, really help.
Yeah. Definitely. Okay. So we are done with the book. And before we leave, if you are enjoying this podcast, we would love it if you left a review on the service that you're listening to the podcast for. We don't have that many reviews. If we get more reviews, more people are going to see our podcast series. More people are going to listen to us and our numbers will go up, which is what we want.
All right. See you later, dear listener. Kim's got a cold.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
Shall I harness the power of the kitten? I cannot tame this creature.